Hello, my little clan. Welcome to episode 1 of my Pillow Talk podcast. Like I said in the longest trailer in the history of podcast trailers, I wanted to do a podcast for a while, but to do one in this style was a bit of an impulsive decision. I did do some work on a podcast in the past for a job, boring corporate BS. Basically. But the handy thing about that was I knew how to release one on Spotify, Apple, wherever you were listening, and set one up and look after the RSS feed. It's very easy. It's not complicated at all. But it's also a little bit dangerous for someone impulsive like me, because it means I could do a podcast and release it to the masses all in one day, while not testing it, didn't ask anyone what they thought. I didn't even sleep in it. I just did it. And that's what I did with the trailer. I recorded a 15-minute trailer. I edited it. I told my Patreon members about it. Told my YouTube members about it. Said, hey, this is coming out next week. It's thanks to you. And that was that. And I'm kind of glad now that I didn't sleep in it, because if I did, I probably would have chickened out. I say that because it takes a while for Apple to approve a new podcast. Spotify just throw it up straight away, it seems. And I didn't want to tell anyone about it until it was available wherever. So because Apple was taking a while to approve it, it got to like Wednesday or Thursday, and I was like, I think I'll just keep this off public. I'll keep it Patreon only. I was worried that my YouTube audience would find it a bit weird, because they're not used to hearing me talk. One, this slow. And two, completely unprepared. The only real feedback that I got up until that Thursday was from my Patreon members. And they loved it. But it's kind of hard to get a read off them sometimes, because I just know them so well and they know me so well. I feel like things go beyond content, in the best way, in a good way. Like if I told them in the morning, hey, I'm not making any more true crime content, I'm going to make content where I'm going to get up every morning and I'll show you my egg boiling, they'd be like, fantastic. We love it. Do whatever makes you happy. I'm telling you, one or two of them would. It's like they care about me more than they care about the content, which is so, so sweet. But it doesn't make a good focus group. So I got to Thursday and I was like, I think I'll just keep this as Patreon only, because I don't want to embarrass myself. I was a little panicky over my accent, even though I shouldn't. But that used to be a big thing for me before on YouTube. I was like a dope for a while, trying to pronounce my H's or my TH's. The three. Because people can't tell the difference between tree and tree, which are two completely different things. I get it. Because sometimes I'm editing back videos and I hear it too. But when I'm saying it, when I'm saying the number tree and a tree that grows, they're completely different things. A tree and a tree. As I'm saying it now, I can hear it. But in my mind, I picture a tree and I picture a tree. So they're different. No, I get it. But for a while, I was trying to pronounce my H's and I just gave up. Because it just feels fake. It feels like I'm acting. So I've just gone back to what's natural to me. But I did get a lot of comments just demanding that I speak proper. And some of them, especially at the start, like I was like, oh Jesus, I didn't realise I couldn't be understood. Because I'm trying to drop my accent in my YouTube videos. The accent that you're hearing now is my real accent. This is how I talk to my friends. But believe it or not, when I make YouTube videos, I'm trying to put on a neutral accent. Not neutral, but it's my work voice, my customer service voice. I know I have a thick accent, so you have to change it somewhat, otherwise people won't have a clue what you're saying. So for a while on YouTube, I was like, oh Jesus, people can't understand me. I need to start pronouncing my H's. The reason I don't anymore is because the people on my channel are like, fuck that. You talk how you talk. We can understand ya. Don't change. And they also started to destroy people that were leaving comments mocking my accent. I just delete them now. Don't worry. But if I ever missed one, there used to be just loads of people underneath just tearing that person apart. Being like, who do you think you are? Which is really nice. And I don't. Obviously, I don't want people to do it. But I'm not going to lie. When I seen it, you just feel kind of protected a little bit. It's like I have a gang. It's like I have a gang of aunts and sisters mostly who are looking out for me. And it's a nice feeling, I won't lie. But all those people have massively helped me with my confidence and self-esteem around how I talk. But that's my YouTube voice. That's me trying my best to be understood. I'm alert. My brain is usually firing because I have all these points that I'm trying to knock off and make sure I get in a video. And like I said, it's like my work voice, or if I was on a phone to a company, that's probably how I talk. But what you hear on this podcast is how I talk if I was talking to a friend or lying on a bed talking to a friend. And try not to talk too loud because I don't want anyone to hear me. This is a private conversation. So long story short, I know my accent is a bit thicker and probably a bit more mumbly. And I was like, oh shit, that's too thick. I'm way too relaxed in that for people to actually understand me. So this was on the Thursday. Apple hadn't approved the podcast yet. I was sitting there. I was thinking about all this. And I was like, just take it off public. Just put it on Patreon. But now that I look back, I was pretty negative with myself and my head around the whole thing. Anytime you do a new thing, it's always a bit daunting. And I was looking for excuses, I think, to back out. So I was just deep in those thoughts, thinking about backing out. And I got a comment on YouTube from a Linda Johnson in New Zealand. And Linda said, I'm paraphrasing her, by the way. My phone is on the other side of the room and it's charging and it's cold and I don't want to get out of bed. But she said, basically, referring to my channel, that her great-grandmother came from County Cork. When she was a little girl, she didn't have a clue what she was saying, so she couldn't understand her grandmother because her accent was so thick. But she said she loved her gaff. She said her house always smelled savage and she was a great cook and the best hugger ever. Lovely stuff, right? But Linda also said she was allowed into her bed for a nap and she loved it. And she got all that from my YouTube channel. Just, I don't know, my accent just reminded me of her grandmother. And then all those feelings came rushing back. And I'm like, oh, that's class. So as I was sitting there thinking about abandoning this podcast, I was like, you know what? Why don't I invite Linda into my bed for an old podcast hug and see if she likes it? So I very sneakily asked Linda what phone she had. I think it was a Samsung. But she said she had Spotify. So I told her, have a little search off my name and have a listen to the podcast trailer. The trailer was up at this time, but I hadn't told anyone about it. But it's just so weird that that comment came at that exact moment and was referencing napping in a bed and all those warm, cozy feelings, which was exactly what I was going for with this podcast. Like, I want you all to crawl into my bed with me once a week for a nap, nothing funky. You need to sign up on Patreon for the funky stuff. But Linda was very intrigued, and she went off to try and listen, try and figure out how to use Spotify. And lo and behold, about 30 minutes later, I got a lovely comment just saying that she really, really enjoyed the trailer, and it reminded her of all those feelings, all those cuddles with her Nana Barrett, Eileen Barrett Ní Murphy. And that was that. I don't know if the timing of that comment was a sign or not, but as soon as I read what Linda said, I was like, fuck it, I'm going to keep it public. I don't care if there are 10 people out there like Linda, 5 people out there like Linda, who get a warm, relaxing hug from this podcast, then I'm happy. And it's strange, it's mad how things work. Linda's great-grandmother, Eileen Barrett, passed away a long time ago, but she's still having an impact, because if it wasn't for her, I don't think you'd be listening to this podcast right now. So, rest in peace, Nana Barrett, and thanks. So that's my little story to start off. It's kind of nice over here to go on little tangents like that. It's freeing. This podcast is probably already the closest thing I've ever had to a therapy session. Speaking of, this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. I'm joking. If you do need that, go get it though. But I don't know anything about BetterHelp other than the ads that they have on loads of podcasts. This podcast is sponsored by my Patreon members and YouTube members and Nana Barrett. Not by BetterHelp. What a fantastic job they've done, BetterHelp. Because as soon as I said therapy there, my brain was screaming, BetterHelp, BetterHelp, BetterHelp. Kind of brings me on to what I really want to talk about in this episode. The Delphi case. Because those of us who've been following the Delphi case probably should be signed up to BetterHelp for what we have put ourselves through throughout the years. I am ridiculously obsessed with the Delphi case. At the moment, I'm extra obsessed, like to a point where it's all I think about. I have stopped even looking at some other cases, which I need to change today, because it's not what I want. I don't want to be stuck on one case. I'd rather talk and dive into a few different ones so I can jump away and jump back. The little break I find is very good, just for my own thinking and clarity. But this case has a firm hold on me at the moment, and I can't wait for the trial to be over. It's all I talked about for the last month on my YouTube channel, and it's probably all I'm going to talk about for the next month. People are very divided on Richard Allen's guilt. I'm in the middle. I won't have my mind completely made up until after the trial. I am running through my thoughts on my channel at the moment. It's not ideal for a YouTube channel, for growth of a YouTube channel, to be in the middle. I have videos coming up that will annoy people who think Richard Allen is guilty, and I have videos coming up that will piss off people that think he's innocent. And people are locked in. Some people are just completely locked in on what they think. And as soon as they hear something they don't like, they'll unsubscribe from the channel, and they just get very hurt at the suggestion that maybe they aren't correct in their current beliefs. Maybe they have bad information. And I love debates and chats with people who have different thoughts than me. I find it very helpful. But I find with some, not folks who've been around my channel for a while, they're cool, because they understand me We've been through a few cases together, and by now, even if we disagree all the time, we won't fall out. We're not kids. But I find with some cases, people do act like stroppy kids. And if you are covering a case, or you're in the middle, or see points even from both sides, you don't do as well as someone who's locked in on either side. It's kind of like the media over in the States. You get one right and one left. You rarely get someone in the middle because nobody watches them, because they say too many things that they don't like. They'd rather consume 100% of things that they want to hear. And I think on my channel, what happens a little bit is a new person might subscribe because they hear me saying something that they really agree with. And then one or two videos later, I'll say something that they disagree with. And for some reason, they really take it to heart. They leave a comment telling me how shocked and saddened they are and how they have no other choice but to unsubscribe from my channel. And when it happens, most of the time, it's from people and usernames that I don't recognise. So that's why I think it's new people mostly. Because I read every comment. You get to know people through their comments. Slowly but surely, I have personalities in my head for people on my channel. I have whole lives built for them. It's probably way off, but that's what I do. I like to visualize people. But when you're reading all these comments over an extended period of time, you kind of get to know that person a little bit. And I adore some of these people. They keep me on the straight and narrow. They keep me in check. They give great advice. They're clever when it comes to cases. They're not easily fooled. Usually been around the block for a while. And I take what they say very seriously. But when it's new people, and it's the first or second comment that they left, I'm not too worried. Now, it could always be someone who's watching and never ever commenting, but usually someone will leave one or two comments, and you know, you can tell by looking at the profile how many comments that person has left in your channel, so you have a fair idea if it's a new person or if it's someone who's been around a while. So when someone new comes into my channel because I say something they really like, and the next video they're gone again, I'm not worried about that. I don't care about the mean comments that they leave when they're unsubscribing. They just don't understand me or thought I was something else. Other people don't understand how I think through things by arguing with myself in videos. But a lot of people who follow true crime online point blank refuse to take in any information that goes against their theory or what they think. They're never wrong about anything, and if they're wrong, it's a conspiracy, but they're not wrong. They only consume information that reaffirms their beliefs, and they block everything else out. They're stuck. They're stuck down a rabbit hole, and most of them will never get out, and they're just going to go deeper and deeper down that rabbit hole and become more and more closed off. And those people are very difficult to communicate with, and they're very difficult to engage with. For me, I can't do it, and I'm not going to go chasing those people or start to make content for them to please them. I want to focus on the people who stick around and don't knee-jerk react every time they hear something that they don't like. Like, they're the best. They are the best. They're not the majority of the overall true crime audience, but they're the best. And I have loads of them. I'm blessed, really. I really am. It's not as much as my sub count might suggest, but there's still a heck of a lot of people there. And a lot of those people are people like me, really, I suppose. That's how I attracted them. people with an unhealthy obsession with true crime and spend hours and hours every week on it, especially active, mysterious cases. To get a break from the active cases, we watch some content that involves closed cases. And that's nice. It's nice to have an ending to a story sometimes. Because for a lot of the cases that I follow or you follow, we don't get that. We don't get the ending. I do not recommend a true crime obsession, especially an obsession with a case. I don't recommend it. Like, the time that you can sink into it is frightening. Like, can you imagine if we were all to spend that time learning musical instruments, how good we'd all be at the guitar, at the piano? We'd be pros. But no, we had to sink our teeth into true crime. We're all a bit tapped, really. We are. Don't hide from it. You're tapped. We have an unhealthy obsession with true crime. If you were listening to this podcast and you're this far into it, you're definitely one of them. I know you are. You have to be. How would you find this podcast otherwise? Like, I'm way too niche for you to stumble across. Episode 1 of a podcast called Delphi Obsession from a YouTube channel that has just talked about the Delphi case for the last month and barely talked about any other cases. So I know you are. You can't hide. You can't hide from me. And at best, you have a borderline obsession. But it's okay. Don't worry about it. Because loads of us do. And that's really what I wanted to talk about on this podcast. I didn't have a plan, but I wanted to call it Delphi Obsession. And during the week, I was thinking about my own Delphi obsession and trying to pinpoint exactly when did I become obsessed? When did this go from just being a case that I follow to, no, I'm actually obsessed with this? It wasn't immediately, because I'd be lying if I said that. And I did try to go back. I have 2 YouTube accounts. One for my channel and one my personal one that I have years. And on my personal one, I tried to go back to see the very first video that I watched on the Delphi case. And unfortunately, it looks like I deleted all my history in 2020. Or else YouTube just doesn't go back that far. But that's as far as I can go back is 2020, which is really annoying because I had the account for years before that. What might have happened is during COVID, maybe I was watching a lot of YouTube. I wasn't liking the recommendations. I deleted the history to try and reset my algorithm. That's the only thing I can think of. Because there's no reason why all the videos I watched before 2020 shouldn't be there. I wanted to know exactly when I came across the Delphi case, because I don't trust my memory of it. I've seen so much footage from the search that I think I may have a false memory of watching this on the Monday or on the Tuesday. It was early on, but I think it's much more likely it was probably the first weekend, the weekend following the murder, because that's when I would mostly watch YouTube. It would be on Sundays in bed, I'd watch YouTube, mostly hungover, and I'd be watching all my true crime content. Maybe it was the Friday, because on the Friday, so just a quick rundown, the girls were killed on a Monday. They were found on a Tuesday, and by the Wednesday evening, they had released the now famous picture of Bridge Guy, just a still shot. They didn't say he was a suspect. They were just like, they didn't say how they got the photo. They were just like, hey, we want to talk to this guy. But by Friday, they had upgraded the photo of the man on the bridge to a person of interest. And like I said, originally on the Wednesday, they were like, we don't know who this guy is. We just want to talk to him. In between those days, on the Thursday, was when Richard Allen, met Dan Doolin, and he said he was on the trails that day. Of course, the vital tip and a key piece of info from someone that was there is lost or misfiled and not remembered by Danny Doolin for 6 years. So Rick came forward after the picture was released. He didn't say that was me. And then the following day, the photo was upgraded to a person of interest. And when it was upgraded to a person of interest, like, that's when it really started to go viral, because everyone was pushing her out. The news were pushing her out. They were like, who is this guy? Even though it's more than likely someone local, and there's only a couple of thousand people in Delphi. But this went viral pretty quick. So really, by the first weekend of this case, it wasn't only going nationwide, it was going global. And it was very obvious that there was something really weird about this case and about the crime scene. And like, there's nothing normal or typical about two girls getting murdered like this on a Monday afternoon in broad daylight. That in itself is frightening and creepy. But when you see the PTSD, basically, in some of the officers' faces, some of the officers that seen the crime scene, you can't help but wonder, like, what happened there? What did they come across in the woods? What did they see? It wasn't so much the words that the officers and the detectives were saying. It was just the look at them, how they looked when they were delivering these press conferences, how they looked in interviews. You can tell something's mental is going on here. Like, what did they see? What did they see in the woods? And the really frustrating thing about all of this is, if Richard Allen is guilty, they should have been raiding his gaff, raiding his home Friday morning, the day after he gave the tip. They would have had to. Like, you have to. A lone male that close to them, dressed like that. If I was Rick and I'm innocent, I would expect them to raid my place. After I gave a statement like that, saying I was there, I wouldn't complain. I would completely understand and probably be helpful, because they have to rule me out because of what I said. And the sooner they search my place, get all this all over with, the sooner they can get back to finding the real killer. And Dan Doolin is terrible at his job. This isn't the first case that Dan Doolin has done some dodgy stuff, but how did he not flag this up the ladder? I'm not sure about Dan. I haven't talked about him yet in a video, but old Danny boy has a bit of a history, and I'm probably going to talk about it at some stage, because he is now so important, because that tip that he said he recorded, and now he can't find the recording, is so important in this case. Especially the word between, not from, between. People think I'm being semantic, picking up on words like that, but that's exactly what the jury will be arguing about when they're deciding if he's guilty or not. You cannot convince me that between means from. And unless there's really good evidence there, or Dan Doolin finds the recording of that tip, it doesn't mean from. It just doesn't. I don't know how dodgy Dan Doolin is, but at very least, he's very shit at his job, and he thinks he's class. But back to the start of the case. When I was watching early on, I was hooked, but I don't think it was an obsession. It was just so mysterious. The images of the bridge and the woods were like something from a movie. The fact that they had a picture of the guy, the reactions of the officers, like I said, to the crime scene. Anyone who is into true crime and into mysteries, it's irresistible and so scary, because Abby and Libby are just normal teenagers. They're just normal teenagers doing what teenagers do. They were loved. They were happy. I've often thought about what it was like in the car when they were going to the trails that day with Kelsey. Kelsey is Libby's sister. She dropped them that day. And she said they were just listening to the radios and the girls were singing along. It was a Monday. School was out. It was a snow day. So it wasn't snowing. But they had extra days that they had to take off. So it was like a scheduled day off school. Monday. Brilliant. Fantastic. The girls were probably buzzing to be off school. And then when Kelsey was dropping them to the trails, she said they were singing along to the radio. But the image of the girls on the way to the trails, on a day off, living their best life, singing along to the radio. And then an hour later, what is happening to them is a horror movie. How can you go from something like that car journey to something like what was happening in the woods? It's a nightmare. Like, genuinely, I haven't seen a horror movie that has come close to what happened here. If I did, I can't remember it. It's one of the worst stories, one of the worst visions that I've ever come across in my life. And it's real. It's not fiction. You know, if you're listening to this podcast, you know what was done to those girls. You know what happened at the crime scene. You've thought about the stuff that I've thought about. It's so disturbing. But early on, you're expecting it to be wrapped up in a few days. Because we didn't know a lot of that. Especially when the FBI gets into town. You're like, just find a psycho that did this. The fact that two girls are dead in the woods is enough. I don't need to be creeped out any more than just that fact alone. Resources were flooding in from everywhere. And they got a picture. They got a picture of the guy. So I was like, he is probably on the run and he's nabbed. Whoever that psycho is that did this, he's going to be caught very soon. I thought it was one person because I didn't know the details that we now know. And they released a picture of one person, so that's what everyone assumed. So by the weekend, I was watching every Delphi video that I could, reading every newspaper article that I could from Indiana. And when I seen the Ron Logan videos that he was given, the interviews that he was given to the media, I was like, oh my God, he did it? That's him? On the off chance that someone is listening to this that doesn't know who Ron Logan is. First off, fair play. I don't know how you avoided that. But Ron Logan was the owner of the property where Abby and Libby were found. The two teenage girls that were brutally murdered. They were found on Valentine's Day 2017. It is believed they were murdered on the 13th, the day before. They were kidnapped from a bridge, taken down a hill, across a creek, and then they were found on Ron Logan's property. His interviews were weird, weren't they? They were. You could kind of tell, without them saying it, that the reporters thought he was dodgy. And so did I. He looked like BG. But the problem is, half the men in Indiana looked like BG, but he seemed a bit weird. He walked a bit like him. They were found on his property. He was old, but he seemed fit enough. And I didn't really understand the terrain at this time. So I just know there's a bridge. I know they were found in the woods. I don't know the exact location in the woods. I don't know what it would take to walk down the hill and walk across the creek. And I don't know what type of effort went into the crime scene. We didn't know how they died. We didn't know anything about the crime scene, other than the officers looked very distressed when they were talking about it. But when Ron Logan was interviewed, you're like, he's a prime suspect. Has to be. And he was. He was. Because within the month, two search warrants were executed on him. So the FBI and the Indiana State Police also thought he was dodgy. One of the reasons they thought he was dodgy, and we found out later, was because he rang his cousin to give him, and not to give him an alibi. Ron shouldn't have been driving at the time, and he was. He was driving around the time that this all happened, the morning and the afternoon. So in the afternoon, he rang his cousin to say, "Hey, can you say you drove me to this place?" Now, Ron didn't lie about where he went, but he lied about getting his cousin to drive him. So his cousin told Ron, "Yeah, sure." But then he got freaked out, as you would. And he told the police, he was like, "Hey, he told me to say I was driving for him. I wasn't." So the FBI, the police are like, "What the fuck is this guy up to?" And two search warrants were executed on his home. They looked hard at him, but you have to expect that. They were found on his property. That's one of the first places you're going to go. He lives close to the bridge. Go. He has to be looked into. And this wasn't the only place that was searched. There was also a search on another property because a mother got freaked out about her son. She thought her son might have been involved. So she tipped him in. And then they went out and they searched her place straight away. Like, you, at the start of the investigation, they have to follow up on everything. And you're also probably panicking a bit because, is this person going to do it again? Are all girls in danger now in Delphi? Like, still to this day, if I had a teenage daughter in Delphi, they're not going out alone. They're not, like, I'm sorry. Like, if you were, it's a public place, but you're not going to any isolated place like this without an adult. No way, not happening. But back to Ron. They searched Ron's place. They found nothing. No charges were ever brought against Ron for this crime. When you dig into it, it doesn't fit. The timeline does not fit. Ron was off buying fish. I just don't see how he could possibly have the time to do this. Is there a chance he has some guilty knowledge? Maybe. Well, he's dead now, so that knowledge is gone with him. But Ron seemed to hate the police. That's what I'm told. He had an extreme distrust of the police. But I also believe, like, maybe that came from the Delphi case. Because the reason they got the first search warrant was because he just tells one of the officers that he has guns when he shouldn't have guns. Like, he thought he was talking to a friend. The fool. Not realising he's talking to a police officer who's definitely going to follow up on that. Two girls are dead in the woods by your house. Of course he's going to follow up on that. Saying that to the police officer, telling that police officer that you actually have guns, and then when he drops you home, like, he invites him in. He invites him into the garage. It doesn't sound like someone who has an extreme hatred of police. It sounds like maybe this incident with this police officer is the reason he has that hatred. But I could be wrong. I could be wrong. Because I'm told he does hate them and he was an old man. So I don't know when that hatred started. But maybe he has some guilty knowledge where he might have an idea of who did it, but he's not going to say. But I don't think he did it alone. I don't think if there is two people involved, he was one of the two people. I just don't see how he was involved. And I know some people are very, very stuck on him. And they think he is. And maybe he is in some way. But I don't think he's the main player here at all. And he never was. They found nothing, no charges were ever brought for Ron for this crime. And if he did it, I believe they would have found evidence in those searches, but they didn't. They then go on to raid Kegan Klein's home, and to be honest, I say when they walked in there and seen that fat cunt sitting there, they were like, it's definitely not him. Look at the state of him. They decided very quickly he wasn't involved, too quickly. in my opinion, and stepped away from him. We didn't know about this at the time. We didn't know about the search on Kegan Klein's home. Kegan and his dad Tony went to Vegas after the Delphi murders, and as soon as they came home, they were raided. During this raid, Kegan makes comments about his dad Tony that, again, at the time, they seemed to just brush aside or overlook. But we didn't even know about that search at the time. And then that was it. Nothing. Nothing in this case for 5 years. And it seemed like it was getting colder and colder and colder. During that 5 years, it seems like every person in Delphi was named as a suspect. I never believed any of it. The whole case was puzzling, and it seemed like it was just getting colder and colder. We did occasionally get some new information, unconfirmed new information, conversations from people who were in the search party. They started to come out, but it was always how unusual and creepy the crime scene was. HLN, Barbara MacDonald and co. did a podcast called Down the Hill, and on episode 5 of that, Robert Ives is speaking. Robert Ives was the prosecutor at the time, and he talked about the crime scene, and he just made everyone even worse. He creeped us all out even more. He talked about how strange, how unusual it was, how there's a religious aspect maybe to it. And I think that was the point for me when I knew 100% this is one of the strangest crime scenes that you can come across. Everything else was kind of rumours and judging off officers' reactions. But when Robert talked, this was the first time that it was kind of confirmed. Because I thought up to that, maybe those officers that were breaking down and were shocked, like maybe they were just shocked at finding two dead girls in the woods. Because most people would be like that. That's understandable. That's normal. But when Robert started talking about the crime scene, and I linked that episode down below, if you haven't listened to it, I highly recommend it. But that for me was when this case became an obsession. For me, it was about 3 years after the murders. The case is going cold, and it should be slipping to the back of your mind where all the cold cases live. But it never left the forefront of my mind at a time when it should have. I was, and still am, very disturbed by the crime, the audacity of it, and the crime scene. The motive, don't have a clue what that is. It's just so strange. The first video that I ever did on the Delphi case on my YouTube channel, I was talking about this basically. The case, there was nothing happening in the case. And I was talking about how it's at the forefront of my mind still, when it shouldn't be. When a case like this should be starting to go to the back of your mind. There's nothing happening. We've no updates. It's going cold. Why am I still constantly thinking about this? And sometimes I intentionally do it. I sit down at a PC and I update Excel files, update my notes, my little Google Earth pins that I have about a number of cases that I follow. But it wasn't like that with the Delphi case at the time, because we had no updates. But I still was thinking about this case several times a week. Out of nowhere, it would just creep into my head. I'm standing in a queue. I'm watching a movie. Going to sleep. I see some teenage girls passing by. And all of a sudden, I'm in my own little world, trying to make sense of what happened on the bridge and in the woods on February 13th, 2017. And I walk a lot in the woods. So maybe that's it. Maybe it was just because I was walking in the woods that it was constantly on my mind because they were found in the woods. I'm not joking though. I'm not going to say every day, but at least 5 times a week, out of nowhere, I found myself thinking about this case, some aspect of it, even though there was no info, and even though it was going cold. And that's where I think the obsession came into it. When you're going to sleep, when you're in the shower, when you're going about your day and you just get smacked with something that makes you think about this case. Because it's no longer then a conscious effort. I'm no longer sitting down being like, I'm going to watch videos on Delphi. I'm going to update my notes on Delphi. Like, even if I tried to stop thinking about this case, I couldn't, because it just had a hold of me. And I just want to know what happened and why. And I want to stop thinking about it. It's not a mystery from 100 years ago where everybody is dead. This is fresh. You have two families getting slowly tortured by this. They're being tortured. I don't think they can process this. Like, I don't think you can process the death of your daughter, of your granddaughter, of your sister, of a family member, of a friend, and grieve properly until you have some assurance that the person or people that did this are caught. And it's now 7 years later. In December 2021, they released the Anthony Schatz profile, and that's when we had a full year of Ken Klein and Tony Klein stuff. That was the first time I thought, right, we're onto something here. The last person to talk to Abby and Libby, Dad Tony, Tony Klein, is a creep with a track record of being a creep. I thought there was something there. I really did. The investigators also did, because I was just following the breadcrumbs that they were giving us. And I was so happy. I was like, yes, they're closing in. Kagan, the liar, he gives an interview at Grissom Air Force Base. He says he was there. He said he was there. He said he waited in a red jeep while his dad, Tony, did it. On the way home, they chucked a phone and a knife, and I can't remember what else he said. It's not out there. This information isn't out there yet, but it will surely at some stage. They chucked things into the Wabash River, and I was like, is this it? Is this finally some truth from Kagan? And they spent a fortune on that river search. Money that they do not have to be just wasting. I estimate that cost with the people there and the accommodation, because we found out where they were staying, that cost in excess of $100,000. They were there for weeks. So I think they might have believed in Kagan, or maybe they just have to, and they have to rule it out. Kagan, being Kagan, apparently, allegedly, it turned out to be more lies. They also raided Tony Klein's mother's, not raided, they searched a burn pit in the backyard of Tony Klein's mother's house, because Kagan said that they burned stuff there in the burn pit. Apparently found nothing there either. But it's what, 6-7 years now? Like, at the time all these searches were going on, they ended, the Wabash River search ended. And I was like, right, if they found something, it's going to take a week or two to process. They'll have to send it to the lab. They'll have to do the testing. If there's enough evidence there, they'll have to go away and get a warrant and see if they can do another search or an arrest warrant. So when news broke of an arrest, and that came very quickly after the Wabash River search, I thought Tony Klein was arrested. I was like, they found something in the river. Took them a week to process it, and they have Tony. So when I heard the name Richard Allen, I was like, who the fuck is that guy? I never heard of him. He was never one of those people that people online were naming as suspects. It seemed to come out of nowhere. Nowhere. I don't know how they got on to Richard Allen. I speculated that maybe they found nothing in the river and they went back to the start. back to the starter case, started looking at all the old tips, and that's how they found Richard Allen. But apparently, that's not what happened. Apparently, they went looking for Richard Allen's name in the tips because his name came up through some other way. I don't know how. Hopefully we'll find out at a trial. And that's where we are. It's now about 6 to 7 weeks before the start of Richard Allen's trial. I still would not rule out some sort of client connection in some way. I don't know what way. Maybe just shared access to a Dropbox. His defense attorneys have said that they need an expert for digital evidence. So a lot of people believe Richard Allen is innocent, but I think they will change their mind if there's evidence to suggest that Richard Allen has a link to some dodgy accounts that could be connected to Kegan Klein. If that happens, things will start to connect themselves together. That's what I want. I want this whole thing to make perfect sense. I want full and true justice for Abby and Libby, their families and their friends. I'm torn on Richard Allen. On one hand, I think he's in a pickle to explain his movements. And it seems like he probably is Bridge Guy. I'm open to changing my mind on that. There might be movements on the trails that day that I don't fully understand yet that'll come out at trial. But at the moment, he seems to be locked in to be Bridge Guy. But nothing after Down the Hill makes sense to me. Richard Allen's history doesn't suggest to me that he would wake up on a random Monday and make his debut into the mass murder scene like this at that age. I don't see a motive. I don't see how he could have done this alone. At the moment, based off what I know, I don't think they can get a conviction, even if he is involved. There's just too much reasonable doubt. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that if Richard Allen is actually involved, they've got some really good evidence that he won't get off with this if he is involved. I've never been so eager and nervous about a trial in my entire life. I hope it's streamed, because it doesn't look like it's going to be. But it's going to be a nightmare trying to understand people's notes and trying to get transcripts. We've already seen that last week. There's so many conflicting reports about what was said at the contempt hearing. I'm just waiting for the transcript to come out, because I don't know what was said. And I feel like the transcript is going to be very different to my current understanding of it. And I don't want to be talking about this case in 6 months' time. I don't want to be standing in the queue to get coffee and thinking about what happened in the woods. I don't want it to be on my mind when I'm going to sleep or in the shower. I want to just break this obsession that I have, but I can't do that without getting answers. I want the truth. I want justice. Like, what if we get all our answers at a trial? What if we get it? Nick the Hero explains everything and we all leave happy, convinced that they got the guy, and maybe it is just a lone wolf crime and I just don't understand it based off the information that I currently have. I'm completely open to that. I would be stunned, but I would accept it if there's evidence. I've no choice. Another scenario that doesn't get much attention that would explain everything is if Richard Allen is guilty but didn't do it alone, and he does some sort of plea deal to give up the people that actually killed Abby and Libby. What if he just did the abduction? What if he just took them from the bridge and then went home, didn't even know what happened in the woods? it's a bit far-fetched. That's a bit far-fetched as well. But it would explain him being BG, and it would explain maybe why it doesn't make sense for Richard Allen to be connected to the crime scene. And it would also nab anyone else involved that is currently walking around a free man. That'd be one of the best scenarios for me for getting answers and moving on. Because people won't be able to argue with that if Rick Allen is guilty and does a plea to give other people up. The worst scenario is if Richard Allen is involved and gets off. Imagine that. Getting away with a crime like this. Or if he's not involved and he's totally innocent and he's convicted. Imagine that. Imagine being treated like that and convicted of a crime like this when you had nothing to do with it. I feel like we're kind of at a crossroads in this case with all those options. I just hope we get answers. I hope we get the truth. I can't predict what'll happen in May. Anything can happen in this case, I'm telling you. Anything can happen. But I don't want any more madness. And sometimes this case feels like you're watching a car crash in slow motion. It's so annoying. It's been over 7 years. And if Richard Allen really did do this, they should have having him in 7 days. They should have having him by the first weekend in this case, not 7 years later. Fingers crossed, come June, July, the summer, when this trial finishes, we'll have some answers and a much better understanding of this case. It's just, this case has become an obsession to me. And a few others, I think, that are listening to this can relate to that. But very few can relate to what the families of these girls are going through. I was moaning earlier a lot about this case coming into my head when I'm in a queue for coffee or I see teenage girls walking about. Can you imagine the family living in Delphi, not knowing if the guy you were looking at is involved? According to the prosecution's timeline, listen to this. According to the prosecution's timeline, Libby's dad, Derek, came very, very close to seeing Richard Allen as he was walking back to his car. Richard Allen is alleged, he must have, having, if he did it, and if this happened, he must have having Libby's underwear and sock in his pocket as he was walking towards Derek. If Derek believes that to be true, which I assume he does, how can you ever look at strangers the same again for the rest of your life? I have no idea what Derek is like, but that would turn me into a horrible, nasty, paranoid person. I'd be like that to every stranger I ever met for the rest of my life. How could you ever look at a stranger the same again? You just couldn't. I really don't understand how they can cope with this or get over it. I don't think they can. I don't think they ever can. It must change you as a person. And I have so much empathy and sympathy for what the family has gone through. It's horrific. Like, I'm mourning about an obsession here on this podcast. What about them? Like, look what they're going through. That's not an obsession. That's a torture. That's what it is for them. So that's it. I just want to end with the family, because that is never, ever lost to me, what they're going through. But I've been obsessed with cases before, but not like this. And I hope it ends soon, which I need to end this podcast. I have no idea how long I've been yapping. So I'm interested in your thoughts. Let me know what you think. Let me know what case you have been obsessed with. Maybe it's Delphi, or you've had one in the past. Maybe this isn't your first rodeo. I'm talking proper obsession though, like the Delphi case. Have you had something like this before? And what was it about that case that dragged you in and kept you there? If you were listening to this on Spotify, you should be able to answer that question somewhere in the app on this podcast page. If you're after listening this far into the podcast, thank you. I don't know how long this is, but it's not short. Please give the podcast a rating on whatever podcast you're on, or leave a review. It's a new podcast, so anything like that makes a massive, massive difference. If you want to leave a one-star review, fuck off, don't bother. I'm only joking. But don't bother. If you've nothing nice to say, don't say it. I don't want to know. But if you do have something nice to say, please do. Right. Thanks again to my Patreon members who sponsored this podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, this content, and or my YouTube stuff, please consider signing up to my Patreon or the YouTube membership, where you can find some more content. I don't do this full time. I hope with your support, maybe one day I will. So thanks for listening, and thanks for crawling into my bed with me. And I'll talk to you next week. Mind yourself. God bless.
Fair maid in this town, whose soul